It now gives me pleasure to introduce the first of this morning's speakers. The person given the honour of giving the first session will espouse the very spirit which I opened my comments with. She will look at the broader impacts of Darwinian thinking. Dame Gillian Beer is King Edward VII Professor Emeritus in the University of Cambridge. She has had a career-long interest in the influence of Darwin on the creative arts and sciences, and is the author, amongst other books, of the much-praised Darwin's Plots, a new edition of which is appearing, I think, Gillian, it's out this year, which lucidly explains how Darwin's narratives overturned many of the fundamental cultural assumptions of the 19th century. Of this work, the New Statesman literary critic wrote, "The only problem with this book is deciding what to praise first." Gillian is also well known as a literary critic, and in 1997, she was the chair of the Booker Prize selection panel. She is a fellow of the British Academy and of the Royal Society of Literature. She will address us today on the topic, Darwin Imagining Others, Observation and Language. Gillian.
Thank you. Darwin's curiosity was boundless. It ranged across the decisions that an infant must make in getting his father's fingers into his mouth, to the erotic ingenuity of orchids, to the likeness between hand and fin and claw. His curiosity concerning large and small events allowed him to move through time between the twirl of a tendril and the interactions that over eons have produced evolutionary organic change. He asked himself radical questions that provoked and continue to provoke questions large and small for others. He asked many different kinds of questions. For him, knowledge is always leavened by other kinds of knowledge. He's able to draw together his formidably wide reading that ranges across travel writing, poetry, philosophy, novels, husbandry, medicine, geology, botany. And he merges all that with his own experiences outdoors, as a boyhood beetle collector, as a pigeon fancier, during his ranging land voyages across forests, plains, and jungles in South America and beyond, in all those years of his mid-20s that he spent on the voyage of the Beagle. Later, his garden and greenhouse and the fields at Down provided fresh impetus to his researches. He experiences also the tensions and contradictions between widely varying forms of knowledge as well as their collaboration. And he corresponded with friends, critics, and professional informants around the world. He employs his own children in counting plants and waking up worms in the middle of the night. His eye is always open for anomaly. He values deviance. Contradiction engages him rather than annoying him. And late in his life, in what's now called his autobiography, written for his family, he remarks on two apparently contrasting impulses in his own thinking. As he modestly puts it, "I think that I am superior to the common run of men in noticing things that easily escape attention and in observing them carefully. But also," he writes, "from my earliest youth, I've had the strongest desire to understand or explain what I observed. That is, to group all facts under some general laws." These twin, yet potentially incommensurable urgencies fuel his insight and his labours. That fascination with the single organism and with the organism in its shifting relations to all the other organisms and forces that make up the current environment is at the core of Darwin's creativity. Yet, collecting, sorting, gathering, and pattern making were crucial to him too. And those processes demand groups, agglomerations, and narratives that may tell quite a different tale from that of the individual. This dual movement in part explains the impact that he's had in quite other fields beyond those of natural science, among anthropologists and poets, among politicians and economists, among fascists and socialists, among novelists and musicians. Darwin's ideas have yielded patterns for understanding, patterns that are themselves often in tension or even in flat contradiction with each other, once extrapolated out. They can be made into stories that tell for or against colonialism or migration. They may seem to declare improvement or decline across the history of the world, shift the majot in one direction, and they become theories of rampant competition only, and a jot in another direction, and they represent a sensitive ecological wisdom. Plenitude and loss strangely combine to form the temper of his discoveries. For Darwin himself, the central story he had to tell was not about humanity. It was a new history of the world that prolonged the past to an unimaginable extent, a past thronging with life abundant long before human presence, plants and birds and animals strange to us, but customary in their time. Few of these past life forms endured into the present, yet they were as crucial to his theory and as thrilling to him as anything he could see now. Moreover, they thickened the meaning of the present as it moved into a future, or rather into multiple possible futures, impossible to describe or descry, so intricate are the shifts and deviances generated by descent. Darwin had seen on his ranging land journeys from the Beagle the sheer variety of the present world, and he continued to discern that variety abundantly in his own garden and greenhouses. He knew also that these particular varieties and this particular abundance were fleeting, subject to change, and soon to be forgotten, replaced by further interlocking forms of life. Extinction was essential to evolutionary process and to Darwin's idea of natural selection. It was ordinary, even wholesome, he thought, and acceptable, perhaps because underpinned in his thinking by his formulation of natural selection as at least implicitly benign, in contrast to the more selfish human procedure of artificial selection. Repeatedly in The Origin, he links the words new and improved in a way that might not now be favoured. To Darwin, nothing was trivial, since his entire theory depended on transmission of slight variations which over time produced huge consequences. On the contrary, Darwin saw how things small and large in scale relate intimately to each other, and how organisms remote in time and place share processes with others close at hand. Yet the world about us seems stable, and descriptions of past fauna and flora recognizable. And the difference between 10,000 years and 100 million years is quite hard to keep in mind. While human beings are locked into 80-odd years only of observing the world directly, Darwin had to work with these staggeringly diverse timescales and to communicate them. And to do so, he needed observation, which requires moment-by-moment scrutiny, being alive and alert to the present. And he needed to record what he'd observed, and beyond that, what he imagined from the evidence. So already at least two timescales were involved, the immediacy of observation, the long weaving of language. They mingle inextricably the individual and the historical community. Fossils and flowers, each with its time frame and its record of change, were necessary to his demonstration. His story insisted on the communality of all life forms, past and present and to come. The human was not set apart. That was, he wrote in The Origin, the grand fact he had uncovered. But he was a human being, writing for other people, in human language. And there was a paradox here that generated, I think, a good deal of the intensity and anxiety in his work. Much of his working life was spent in contemplating the activities of barnacles and climbing plants, as well as other animals. But language is required to secure the record. Language with its historical and communal freight of endurance, and yet its slippery anthropocentric assumptions. In The Descent of Man, he described language as half art, half instinct, and as still evolving. Language is specifically human. But one task Darwin had to undertake was to find means of registering the experience and activities of other life forms within the means of human language. He did not much use maths. In his early notebook, he cautioned himself not to overplay language as if it offered humans alone the possibility of communicating. He writes there, "The distinction, as often said, of language in man is very great from all animals. But do not overrate. Animals communicate with each other. They likewise must understand each other's expressions, sounds, and signal movements." For Darwin, the kinship of humankind with all other life forms is fundamental to his theory. He writes again in those early notebooks, "We're all netted together." That is, we're all knit together in one great family, descended, diversified, and sorted through time. And this is not a matter of likeness of structure only, but likeness of emotions and aesthetic feelings too. He wrote in one of those early private notebooks, "I cannot help thinking horses admire a wide prospect." Elsewhere in those same notebooks, jotted down when he was in the midst of precipitating his crucial evolutionary perceptions, and of course also secret, so able to risk extreme ideas, he writes, "The tastes of man, same as in allied kingdoms of animals and plants, food, smell, music, colours. We must suppose the peahen admires peacock's tail as much as we do, presaging sexual selection, of course. Touch, apparently. Orangutan very fond of soft silk handkerchief. Not only are tastes shared, but expressions." He writes, "Contempt, look obliquely. So does dog when a little one attacks him." He asserts that arguing from man to animals is philosophical, that is, stable and scientific. He argues for a sort of reverse anthropomorphism. We don't simply falsely impute human emotions when observing animal behavior. We share emotions with them because we are all animals. He observes children and orangutans, dogs and men, plants and oysters. He wonders whether plants have an idea of cause and effect, for instance, or whether oysters have free will. He could risk anything in those private notebooks. He observes fear and joy, rage and reasoning in infants before they speak and in animals communicating with each other. In The Origin of Species, he barely mentions mankind. And though he thought of this as what he called a diplomatic move, which wouldn't perturb people so much, it certainly greatly perturbed his contemporaries, since it consigned the human simply to the primate group and gave no special place or dignity or possibility of ensoulment to us. He thinks with particular intensity and pleasure about the expressions of the emotions for 30 years, from the late 30s on, until he finally published Expression of the Emotions in 13 years after The Origin of Species. Rather than being outliers from his main work, all these ideas of kinship, of similitude, and also of diversity are foundational. Darwin observed the congruities between the human and other life forms, though he sometimes felt puzzlement, even occasional exasperation at the sheer inventiveness of forms in nature. For instance, when he's writing about orchids, he writes, "Hardly any fact has struck me so much as the endless diversities of structure, the prodigality of resources for gaining the very same end, namely the fertilization of one flower by the pollen from another plant." How far, then, can human beings truthfully record the experience of other life forms? This question seems to have haunted Darwin throughout his professional life, which was also always his personal life. Can language escape its human preoccupations? Language, as he observed, because itself evolving, is not a steady arbiter that can stand outside human history. Darwin read a great deal of language theory during his 30s, and he used the German comparative grammarians as a model for his early inquiries. Language also always includes intent. So you formulate something like natural selection, and immediately people start saying, by whom or what selected? But what if the natural world is free of intention? Now, we tend to think of Darwin as almost omniscient, and he was certainly polymathic, but he was not universally competent. He thought himself rather unskilled in dissection. He was absolutely not a mathematician, though he did enjoy Euclid, and he lacked talent in drawing. Now, that was a very important constraint to him professionally. Whereas his peers Henslow and Hooker could represent life forms, particularly plants, in exquisite and reliable detail, Darwin could at best present diagrams, mainly in geology. If you go to the Fitzwilliam, you'll see one very fine one that he produced. This had the effect of making him extremely reliant on writing. In his field notes, diaries, and letters while on the Beagle voyage, he learns to describe and evoke objects that he will almost certainly never see again. He realizes that his descriptions must thus be both accurate and vivid, if they're to carry sufficient information in the absence of a sample. And samples, though crucial if they could be preserved and transported, were subject to all the ills of time, sea voyages, and possible shipwreck, as Alfred Russel Wallace knew all too well. So writing was a more secure supplementary system for memory, and equally important as evidence with his samples. He always struggled with writing. He noticed how hard he found it to present simple, clear-cut sentences. But he gradually came to see that this struggle is part of the process of thinking new thoughts, thinking against the bias of the expected, a necessary tug that makes him aware of the strangeness of things. Not everything will conform. Darwin's curiosity was, as I've suggested earlier, remarkably without hierarchy. He could puzzle as readily on whether an oyster has a necessary notion of space as on whether music preceded language primordially, or, as he wrote in The Origin, on why should one crustacean, which has an extremely complex mouth formed of many parts, consequently always have fewer legs, or conversely, those with many legs have simpler mouths? Why should the sepals, petals, stamens, and pistils in any individual flower, though fitted for such widely different purposes, be all constructed on the same pattern? His theory relied on such curiosity, on raising questions and seeking, however long it may take, answers to them, because he was not simply a question raiser, but an answer seeker. So the paragraph I've just quoted, for example, occurs very late in what he calls this long argument on page 353 of The Origin, and it can begin to be answered by the opening of the next, which starts, "On the theory of natural selection, we can satisfactorily answer these questions." This prolonged process of discovery contrasts with what he calls on the page before the ordinary view of creation, which in his view is null and atemporal, I quote him. "On the ordinary view of the independent creation of each being, we can only say that so it is, that it has so pleased the Creator to construct each animal and plant. Curiosity has no place in such a system, and Darwin repudiates it. The emphasis on long process in his method of argumentation accords with the nature of the world that he believes he is uncovering. Similarly, he makes cautious use of the principle of analogy in his argument, always considered a very dangerous persuasive tool, and yet analogy is also what he claims he is uncovering in the form of morphology, the physical likenesses of structure between unlike kinds. So his rhetorical moves align with the outcomes of his ideas. This could be a bad thing intellectually, since it risks winding the topic into a cocoon of its own making. But for him, analogy is simply a strong working tool, uncovering hidden affinities between superficially unlike kinds, affinities disguised by the long processes of change and variation. Analogies, he sees, can thus properly prove to be, from time to time, homologies, revealing not simply likeness, but identity between extraordinarily diverse creatures in extraordinarily diverse times. This process of thinking and expression allows him to uncover both the sequences of change and the inalienable kinship between humans and other forms of life, extant and extinct. For his contemporaries, and indeed still for many, this kinship is not a comforting idea, but it's an idea that expands the horizons of concern as well as of knowledge, and such stretching of the boundaries is the source of Darwin's universal impact. Thank you.